Thank you. Oh, do I get one? Thank you. You know, it's good to be back. I was here 2 years ago and spoke to a group, and I admire the steam that you have in your lungs to continue to listen to a story that I had hoped when I was here last time would be soon behind us. But it isn't. It comes a little bit like springtime comes to Seattle. I drove this afternoon from the airport to Jerry and Bob Haynes' home, and it looked so beautiful and so peaceful and so clean. This is unfortunate that one has another story to tell that also keeps coming up, and that's the story on which I have spent a good deal of time since I saw you last time. I had the good fortune of a grant which allowed me to stay in Geneva to really go into the depth of the documentation that is available. The truth is there. The truth is absolutely researchable. And if you combine what documentation from your government, from the British government, from the United Nations, from the Iraqi government, if you combine that with the experience that my destiny made me to have, then you get a picture. And the picture is a very clear picture. As I wrote this book, I kept saying to myself every day, I really didn't know that I was a sculptor. Because a sculptor, I guess, also takes a raw piece of stone, and then he starts, or she, carving. And gradually, and he doesn't, I kept saying, I know the destination of where I want to go with this book, but I don't know which stations I will pass as I go along. And I guess a sculptor has a little bit that. He will start, he knows he wants to make a face and a body or whatever, and then gradually something emerges. And today, I must tell you, I come with a lot more self-confidence than I did last time. Last time, I had my experience, and out of this, I made a presentation. I chuckled a little bit when I just walked in and I saw there's a video about 90 minutes, Hans von Sponeck. I always have a tendency to be long-winded and to talk too much, but I pledge to you, for very human reasons, tonight it won't be 90 minutes. It will be a little bit less, because I haven't seen my wife for a while, and she happens to have come from Germany, where I live now, to go to her family across the bay to Bremerton, and I have to catch a ferry. So that's very human, I guess, and you allow me, therefore, that I will press on to present to you, and a story that is troubling to you. I salute you without flattering you. I don't know many of you. I know Jerry and Bob. I'm very grateful to them. I know my good friend Bert Sachs. And I know the congregation, and I thank all of you for inviting me again, for the sponsorship, the support. And please don't underestimate what a support can mean to people in my situation who are constantly walking a tightrope. Our motives are questioned. Newspaper articles are written. We were talking about this earlier, which suggests that I've done something that one shouldn't have done. Well, I can assure you, I wouldn't be here if I had. It's a story that brings many faces together. And is about something which was avoidable, clearly avoidable. The United Nations had options, and it chose the hardline option. It didn't have to do that. Well, let me begin here. Now, what I want to say is, if you came across someone who would say to you, and maybe you have, if there was no United Nations, we would have to invent it. You have heard that maybe. And I would say there's no debate in a group like this one about that statement. No one will doubt that we need an international body, call it United Nations or something else, that is needed in this complex, shrinking world, globalized world. We need such a body. But the debate will be a debate about what kind of a United Nations do we need, do we want, and if we there ask around, we will get many, many answers. And I plotted down the spectrum of perceptions that one could hear. One extreme, I won't tell you who said it, but you will know it, is the United Nations needs to consist only of one nation, and that is the U.S. That's one perception. The gentleman who said it is in office today. No, it is not Mr. Bush. He wouldn't say that. He is reserved for other statements that are of concern maybe to some of us. But it was somebody who is at the United Nations right now. That's the one position. The other position is the United Nations should be that we want, that we need, should be a UN that represents us all, a world government. Well, we are far, far away from that moment. And thank God we are also far from the moment where the UN consists only of one member state. Somewhere in between is where we want to belong. And I think in saying that, we all recognize that the UN isn't and has never been perfect. The United Nations is, as the Financial Times of London in November last year said, the United Nations is vital, but is flawed. And one can say that and pursue that and explore what that means, but let me be for a moment positive. There is a quiet United Nations, a United Nations that you don't read about, that we would like to see in the news, but good news these days is bad news, and bad news is good news. That's unfortunate. And therefore, the good news that the United Nations can produce, you don't read much about. That's what I call it, the quiet United Nations. The UNICEF that deals with concern of children, with healthy water, with inoculation, with primary education, the World Health Organization that is involved in disease control very heavily right now with the avian flu discussion, for example. You have UNESCO concerned with education. You have the UNIDO concerned with industrial development. You have FAO concerned with agriculture. You have all kinds of institution. In fact, you have a network that was created over 60 years. This year is the 61st year of existence of the United Nations. So here's a structure. And you also have content. You have created an enormous body of knowledge has become available in all these fields, supported very ably. And unfortunately, in the press, ridiculed as wastefulness, the international conferences that took place, for example, housing in Istanbul, water in Argentina, population in Cairo, social issues in Copenhagen, women's issues in Beijing, and I could continue a long catalog where one worked hard before, worked hard during the conference, and the world consists today of 191 member countries, and therefore you will have a large number of people flocking to these meetings wherever they take place, and a cynical press will say, look at this waste. 10,000 people are going to Cairo to attend a population conference. Yeah, they enjoy cocktails, they fly business class, and they waste taxpayers' money. Maybe. I don't think so, though, because I saw when I was in India as the UN representative for some years, I saw how hard the Indian government was working with NGOs, with civic leaders, with us to try to prepare for this conference. How they even went as far as preparing the legal basis on which to approve the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the CEDAW Convention, which was signed just before the Indian delegation went to China to participate in the Women's Conference. After they came back, there was a lot of dialogue, networking, to try and translate this into some improvement in the legislation, of course, and in cooperation between different entities that did work relating to the rights of women and the participation of women in development. So there was a lot, and there is a lot of good that one can say about these conferences. So we have the network, we have the content, and what is missing, the third pillar, is really is international law. And in 60 years, a lot of international law has been created to protect us, to protect you, to protect me, to protect anyone in these 191 member countries. What am I talking about? First of all, you have what is always with me and which is very important to me, and I discover more and more how wise this document was, in which American leaders participated. Eleanor Roosevelt, George Bundy, and others participated in creating this structure, this United Nations Charter. That's international law. But the UN, the international community, always with strong support over many years of the United States, created conventions, created law. There is today an International Bill of Human Rights, which guarantees, or is meant to guarantee, political, civic, cultural, social, and economic rights. There are conventions. There is the Genocide Convention. There is the Torture Convention. There is, of course, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And how sad is it that the rights of the child, a seemingly innocent convention, hasn't been signed yet by two countries? I say countries because one country doesn't have a government and the other one has a government. So I say two countries. The country without a government, a real functioning government, is Somalia, and the country that has a government is the United States. These are the two that have not signed the conventions on the right, or the Convention on the Rights of the Child. That is sad, because don't we all want to protect what is ultimately maybe the finest thing one could have, and that is a child. But it is not, hasn't happened. But my main point is that in 60 years we have a body of international law, we have a structure, we have agencies that deal with the concerns of our world. And the real question then arises is, why is this gap between where we are today on this 24th of March 2006, why are we where we are and are not where we could be? This big gap that exists. And the answer one could give, of course, one cannot give in an evening talk. And I'm not even sure that I'm competent to give you a holistic picture of the complexity. But I can single out a couple of areas which are, to me, are part of the picture. One for sure is the dynamics of globalization. I'm coming back to this in a moment. The other one is the unilateralism of one country, of one government, I should say. And that is, unfortunately, your government. And so you have choices to make. On globalization, some of you have, because I talked to some of you before, you have read this frightening book by John Perkins, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And when you read that, you see the linkages. I didn't know. I was in a public international institution. I had every opportunity to discover, but I didn't. The linkage between economics, politics, intelligence, and development, and finance, lending institutions. Well, that book makes that point. So we have choices to make. The road that looked like a straight road, suddenly you come to a road fork and you have to decide. Do we want to go the road of what I describe as market Darwinism, where you you box your way ahead by all means, and it's about profit. We used to joke in the UN in referring, that wasn't quite fair, to the World Bank by saying the World Bank is only interested in that which you can count. What you cannot count does not count. Well, there is that approach, profit, consumption, at all costs, physical consumption. That's one choice. We can go on that road. The other choice, of course, is a very beautiful one, which I couldn't possibly have said as nicely and as humanly as Johann Galtung did. Johann Galtung, this international figure who has all his life, he's an older man now, tried to solve conflicts peacefully, to help governments and groups and universities to go the peaceful way. And he defined in a very publicized exchange with Samuel Huntington last October in Germany. The two met and they debated, and he came up with this wonderful definition of globalization, the other road. A system in which men and women, the three generations which inhabit Earth at the same time, all races, all men, live together in dignity. I think that is a wonderful description of that other road that one could take. And the UN Charter is very closely aligned with that very definition. That's what it is about. It's about tolerance, it's about equal opportunity, it's about giving men and women the same chances, and so on. So much maybe about globalization. About unilateralism, I think this is a temporary detour that one country has chosen, to use an American colloquialism, to go it alone. I don't think this is the choice of many people that I talk to, at least as I travel through North America, but it is a present reality. And we have to understand this, and we have to also understand, or try to understand, what motivates this. But while Europe is full these days to debate why this is so and what it is, I always say to my friends and colleagues and others whom I meet, you don't waste your time. Look at two documents. I would have said 3 weeks ago, now I say look at three documents. The first document to understand this unilateralism is PNAC, it's the Project for the New American Century, which is a non-governmental document. It's a think tank piece, and even though many of the people who were associated with it are not academics, are people in high office. For example, Mr. Wolfowitz was one of the signatories to this document. He's now the president of the World Bank. That's one document. The other document is what was filtered out by the present administration and is called the U.S. National Security Strategy. That's the second document. If you read those two, they are fairly similar. And the message is, at all costs, economically, socially, politically, culturally, militarily, we must retain leadership, supremacy. And if that means going to war, so be it. If that means to go through a war without international support, so be it. And the third document is only a few weeks old. It was presented by the chief of general of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Pace, to the U.S. Congress, which was called the Fourth Quarterly Defense Review. And in that document, you see references to the fact that one must expect a long war, a multiple intervention, military intervention in different countries at the same time to fight extreme Islamist fundamentalism, three heavy words. You read this and then you know where you stand. And I must recognize the consistency, and I must, one can only be impressed by the bloody mindedness, if one can use that term, It's quite descriptive, with which this strategy is pursued. One must despise it also. But one sees a consistent line here. And that may be giving the you, and you know that better, but to others also, the picture. But there are individual indicators of a process that started not just under the present administration, of an increasing sort of Monroe Doctrine orientation, isolationism maybe, going it alone, as I said before. The U.S. decided not to join the International Court of Justice. You know that. The U.S. decided not to support the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. decided not to adopt and sign into law the Landmine Convention. Landmines are still one of the major reasons for maiming people, civilians, innocent people around the world. And as I mentioned, many of the conventions are not signed. No, that's not fair. Some of the conventions are not signed by the U.S., like the Children's Convention. And surely there is Iraq as an example of a unilateral approach, because Iraq happened outside of any international a system, outside the Security Council. And the question of where are we and why couldn't we be here, the gap, one has to refer maybe as a third element also to the realities in the United Nations. The United Nations is suffering from fundamental structural weaknesses, such as for example, no division of labor between the International Court of Justice, between the General Assembly, and between the Security Council. The Security Council over the years has usurped more and more of what could and should be a responsibility of the General Assembly and the International Court of Justice in The Hague. I'm not talking about the Criminal Court of Justice, but the International Court of Justice that is also included here in the UN Charter and is in fact a UN body. There is no division of labor. That is unfortunate and has had very many negative side effects. Then there is a poor coordination between that system that I described to you. That isn't helpful in doing the kind of things that the United Nations should be doing. In my days in Baghdad, what was a particularly apparent weakness of the UN was what one can describe as the consensus approach. A consensus approach is when you have these 15 people, 15 governments that are in the Security Council, they sit together, they take decisions on the basis of the common, lowest common denominator approach, and reflect that in resolutions. And the resolutions allow them to say, we have agreed. But when it comes to the implementation of these resolutions, all the disagreements come out again, and we have seen that. And I want to give you evidence of what I mean here. But before I do that, I want to say it took many, many years before a Secretary General of the United Nations had the feeling, had the vision to come out and say, and I read to you, consensus promotes generalizations and prevents serious efforts to act. I'm glad that Kofi Annan did that, because that's exactly what we in Iraq suffered a lot, with great human costs to the Iraqi people. You had resolutions, early resolutions, United Nations resolutions in Iraq, which, for example, were referring to Iraq must have completed all actions. Iraq must fully cooperate. What does that mean, fully cooperate, and must have completed all actions? If we ask around, we will get many different answers, and that is exactly why the resolution was accepted in the first place, because you could interpret it in this way, you could interpret it that way, and I in another way. As long as it was fairly harmless, one would get away with that. But then comes a resolution like Resolution 1441 of November 2002, the last big resolution before this illegal invasion into Iraq in March 2003, where the consensus resolution talked about breach of agreement and serious consequences. And the French, the Brits, the Chinese, the Bangladeshis, or whoever else, the Chileans, the Guinea-Bissau representatives, saw different things in these words. And certainly the Americans had a different interpretation, and the British likewise, as I said. And serious consequences meant to some more sanctions, more pressure, but certainly not military confrontation. And yet, in the end, this was a pretext for going to war, because the US government felt, the British government felt, the Spanish government felt, the Italian government felt, that there were a serious breach of agreements, and therefore serious consequences had to follow, and that meant military confrontation. In this context, what I want to say here is that, unfortunately, the United Nations was not able to solve this or other major conflicts that have arisen in our days. North Korea, UN didn't play an important role. Palestine, the UN isn't playing. It's a member of the quartet, but isn't playing a very significant role at all. In fact, it got a few slaps into its face in the process of trying to be useful, but certainly didn't play a leadership role. The UN hasn't even played an important role in giving a definition of international trade, of fair trade practices. Seattle knows about fair trade practice discussion because you were, I think, here very active during the days when the World Bank and the Bretton Woods institutions met in Seattle. There's not even an agreement or leadership role when it comes to the Millennium Development Goals about education, about disease control, about more water and better water quality, and very innocent, seemingly innocent issues. And I think that is why one has to prescribe so much urgency to a UN reform, a new architecture of the United Nations. But to me, having now really studied this in relationship to my own experience in Iraq more in detail, I can tell you that the Iraq case, is the best case one can possibly make for the need for UN reform. I want to pause here for a second and just let us remember one thing. A nation, 23, 24 million, 25 million people, who have had for 30 years a dictatorship, who have had for 13 years sanctions, who have had two wars and one illegal invasion, and who have had three, soon 4 years of occupation. I want to ask you, how much can a people take? How much can a people endure? And I am surprised that the Iraqis can still be so strong in their optimism when you talk to them, when you talk to individual Iraqis. There is a lot that simply makes it impossible to believe that one can be optimistic. But that is the strength of a nation. I would say one can and must. One can quantify the human catastrophe that has affected and afflicted Iraq. I wanted to say I fully accept the political demand of our politicians in Europe and in America and elsewhere that we must look forward. Yes, we must look forward. But there is something called political accountability. We also have to look backwards. We have to make sure that we account for what we did in the past. And that's what that process has to start. It cannot be that Condoleezza Rice goes to Santiago de Chile, attends the inauguration of the first female president in that country about a week ago, and she said in front of everybody, time has come that we must forget about the past. And she said it in the presence of the new president of Chile, who spent years in jail because of Pinochet. That cannot be. So we have to account for the past before we look to the future, in my view. So in trying to do this, one can take what looks like a fairly uniform fluid, I call it a cocktail here, that hides what goes on the account of Saddam Hussein, what goes on the account of member governments of the United Nations, and what goes into the account of the UN Security Council. One can separate these different fluids, if you want, and answer the question, who is accountable for what? I want to very quickly go through that by saying, Saddam Hussein, of course, the big picture about this dictator is painted. We know enough, that is plenty of evidence that he was a very brutal person and is accountable. We know about the Anfal campaign in northern Iraq. We know about the campaigns in the southern marshes of Iraq against the Marsh Arabs, as they are called. We know the plight of the Shia clerics. We know of individual cruelty against members of the Iraqi society. The detail will be in, the difficulty will be in defining the detail. And there will be a debate, and you will see in the newspapers of the years to come endless debates about whether this was really as it was or not. New declassified information will become available that will show you, as we have seen now, the water documents that were released on the deliberate bombing of infrastructure in Iraq in 1991, the Second Gulf War. But now come suddenly other surprises about the gassing of the Kurds, where there's now a Department of Defense paper that shows, seems to argue that cyanide was not used by Iraqis, but only by Iranians. A lot of this information, half-truth, new facts, so one has not a very clear final picture of the detail. Let me halt here, because our time is running on. As far as member governments are concerned, well, if you take the analogy of the account a little bit literal, then you can say deposits are still made every day. The inputs, we see the picture emerging, and it's a gruesome picture in Iraq with more and more suffering that has as a cause, not the cause, but a cause, the occupying forces. The final picture there isn't yet clear, not even in big brushes. But when it comes to the UN Security Council and the period of sanctions, 13 years of sanctions, one can say very definitely what happened. And my book, which I wrote in English, by the way, and it's published in Arabic and in German, because until recently now I have an Oxford, New York publisher, but I couldn't find a publisher, and you can imagine why I couldn't find a publisher. But I have one now, a good one, and it will be hopefully a book that's worth reading, and it puts facts on the table. Among the facts are that we laid, the UN laid, I could give you details, and maybe you want to ask a question on this. We, in the very beginning, in 1990, when sanctions started, they were legal, but when the configuration of the sanction programs was discussed, it became increasingly illegal because we hadn't done good homework. The basis was not a good basis on which to build a subsequent oil for food program. And the beginning of, the approach was much too punitive. This was all along visible, that it seemed we wanted to punish internationally Iraq. Well, I would concede that this was something one could do to refer to Saddam Hussein, but not to civilian people. And that's so we punished the wrong party. That became very clear, and lots of details, I assure you, are available. If you want to know, we can discuss. Then came much later, for explainable reasons, also the Oil for Food program in 1996. Well, grass doesn't stay under the rocks, as a proverb goes, and facts are coming out. And the facts that are coming out are pretty gruesome. I could bombard you now until my fairy leaves with statistics. I will not do that. I will collapse this into one, however, two reliable statistics. One is that the entire value of what the Oil for Food program produced and brought into Iraq as so-called humanitarian supplies, it was all Iraqi money. I think I mentioned that before. Every penny of what was classified as humanitarian supplies came from Iraqi oil revenue. My salary was paid with Iraqi oil money. So was every other UN official's salary. It was the biggest program the United Nations had ever undertaken, and it was the cheapest program the UN had ever undertaken, because there was not $1 of contribution. It was all done, all financed by Iraq, but it was called humanitarian. Now, the total value of per capita value, per person per year of the so-called humanitarian value for goods that came into Iraq was $185. Now, $185 is a figure, is something you can imagine. This was $185 for what? For food, for medicine, for water, for sanitation, for electricity, for agriculture, and for education. And towards the end of the Oil for Food program, telecommunication and construction were added. The total value of what came in, $185 per person. They had, most of the Iraqis, as you, Jerry, and you, Bert, know, didn't have anything else. They relied totally on that. Now make it more understandable. Bring it down from the 185 to a figure that we can even more comprehend. I stayed in a hotel the other day where they charged for a bagel $2.35. The $185 per year per person translates into 51 cents, the figure you know, per person per day. That's what they had, 51 cents to finance all these items that I mentioned to you. Impossible. And this is where the drama starts as far as the UN, the third account, is concerned. Because the UN had options. The UN could have easily said, you can repair your oil industry, you can pump more oil so that you have at least $2, $3, $4 per person per day, and you can repair some of your civilian infrastructure. That was not done. And the indicators, the social and economic indicators that came out of that, that came resulted from all that, are incredible. An unemployment rate of 60% to 75%, a mortality, child mortality, that was the highest, the increase of any country anywhere was in Iraq. And what I find very unfortunate at the moment is that an academic debate about the accuracy of these figures, is now seeping over into the public. Let academics, by all means, debate whether the rigor was adequate or not. To me, on the political side, it's not important. One child that dies as a result of a wrong international policy is one child too much, too many. And the same applies to any person in Iraq who died because he couldn't get the medicine or whatever. And I think that is something which we have to look at, and we have to understand better, and we have to ask the question, who was responsible for not taking these options? More revenue, less bureaucratization. It took an immense number of steps to get something from, let's say, from Seattle to Baghdad. It took between 8 and 12 months at times. The one exception was food. Food worked fairly well. We moved 440,000 tons of food every month to feed a nation. That was all right. But the rest, medicine, water purification materials, electricity components, educational material, hopeless, difficult, frustrating, and the end result was everywhere you looked. I would like one day that I have a meeting with some of you to just spend an hour to talk about what happened in education. I think all of you will, your eyes will water, because it is so shameful what we did. And I'm not saying, please do not misunderstand me, I'm not saying US. I'm saying we, I say Security Council, I say international community. That we allowed a proud system of education to collapse and punish the most vulnerable, the youth. They are going to pay 20 years from now, when nobody, hopefully nobody talks about Iraq anymore, they will still feel it. They will still feel the incapacity they have. There were many aspects that surrounded this package of sanctions. Of economic sanctions. One dramatic example I just want to refer to, the no-fly zone, and no-fly zones. These zones were illegal. There was no UN mandate. No one internationally had accepted these zones, except France, the UK, and the US. And France dropped out in 1996. Until that time, the no-fly zones were benign. There was no aggressiveness. But after Operation Desert Fox in December 1998, it became an increasingly destabilizing, aggressive interaction in Iraqi airspace, with quite a large or increasing number of civilian casualties and also death and wounded. So, without going into further details, I think the conclusion can only be that the United Nations failed in Iraq. And out of that comes then the demand, the rightful demand, that we build in controls into this United Nations to prevent this from recurring again. And two catchwords here are multipolarity and multilateralism. We cannot have a United Nations that has only a Western agenda, ladies and gentlemen. Walden Bellow, he may be known in Seattle, I don't know, this Filipino activist, peace man, a wonderful person. He reminded the International Physicians Against Nuclear War in Frankfurt last January by saying, hey, you people from the West, could you be a bit more humble? Could you sometimes keep your big noses, you have bigger noses than we have, keep them out of our affairs? You mustn't interfere in everything that we do. Let us handle it in our own way. I think that's something which is relevant in the UN reform discussion. The UN debate is largely a Western debate, Western agenda. We dictate what is important. To us at the moment, what is important? HIV/AIDS? Yes. The terrorism debate is very important to us because we are worried about our security. Where we make a huge mistake, in my view, and I hope that you go along with what I say now, is that we fight terrorism's symptoms, but we do not fight terrorism's causes. We must do much more to fight the causes. And if we start doing it, we are already in entering the other agenda, the agenda of large number of countries around the world who say terrorism has something to do, well, with such a general term as dignity. Yes, it has something to do with dignity. Some people go and die because of dignity or lack of dignity, because they feel humiliated. It has nothing to do, I heard people who said in interviews, poverty, but these 19 people who are responsible, so if they are, for 9/11, they were all from middle-class families. That is no argument or no evidence that poverty has nothing to do with the turbulence in which we are today. And therefore, it has to be taken account. And the whole terrorism discussion, to me, is a discussion with emphasis in the wrong direction. And if we switch a little bit, I tell you, that has confidence-building measures enormous. In individual talks with people in Asia and Africa and outside of Europe and North America, I feel again and again that what these people expect is what it says in that UN Charter. equal opportunity. We have priorities, they have priorities. So let's have a UN agenda that is truly multilateral, and let us have a different composition in this UN Security Council, for example. You cannot have a UN Security Council that was created in 1945 when there were 52 member countries and handle a much more complex agenda when there are 191 member countries 60 years later. So we have to bring in a truly multilateral agenda, and we have to bring in a new architecture of representation also. Is it right that the five victors of the Second World War are the permanent members in the Security Council in 2006, when countries like India and Brazil and South Africa and others that have created or have become important nations are just hoping that sooner or later sometime will become elected for 2 years into the Security Council? It's not right. And there's increasing resentment to this and confrontation. And I think that has to be changed. Now I'm very close to what I felt I wanted to say, but I always feel I need to include in my presentations, each one is a little bit different, of course, because different things come to your mind as you speak that are things that are hopefully relevant. But it was not yesterday. It was in 1945 that the delegate, the Mexican delegate to the United Nations signing conference in San Francisco, he said, "We have designed, United Nations, we have designed an organization which will control the mice, but the tigers are still on the loose." That was said in 45. Well, how relevant is that quote today? The only difference is that the tigers today are so fat and the mice are still very thin and they have no voice. It's not what Churchill argued in 1945, the same year he said in Yalta, when the whole question of what next with Germany was discussed, he said, "The big birds must let the smaller birds sing." Well, I keep saying the big birds must let the smaller birds sing is fine to say that, but that isn't enough. The little birds must, their song must also be heard and taken into account. And in a reformed United Nations, I think that is what is called for. We cannot, as one hears sometimes, say Liechtenstein, Fiji, Bhutan, these tiny little nations have the same voice as China and India. Well, doesn't it enrich the debate when you have more voices? So let there be more voices, and one shapes an agenda. And one very last word relates to this tough, and be sure it will be a tough discussion about the reform of the UN Security Council. There, I think one will have to rethink. When the Secretary General said in such a relevant way that governments and civil society have to talk together, that to me means in the year 2006 that the Security Council must reflect that. Just why, I ask you, should only governments be in the Security Council? Why couldn't there also be NGOs? Some people say that will make it even worse, more complex, and so on. Well, but you then have a much greater chance that the extreme voices of power are silenced by arguments and by courage. The governments in the Security Council don't have courage vis-a-vis each other. Because if I hit you today, you hit me tomorrow, because you are also there in the Security Council. So you want to make sure that there is some other element that says, you are telling me that in Iraq, Saddam Hussein is stockpiling medicines and is selling food in the market. And the other governments sort of don't say very much. No one gets up and says, hey, what you're saying is totally wrong. The chances that this happens are much greater when there is another group NGO community, for example. And this is no longer so much dreaming. A few years ago, what I just said to you would have been very naive dreaming. But now it's coming out. Secretary General himself refers to this. But I want to dream a bit more, and then I end. The dream that I have is that we have this multi-layer security council where you have governments, where you have NGOs, and where you have a council of elders. We have 6.5 billion people. I think we'll get 30 integer international figures known for their experience, have gone through life, sincerity, honesty, and say, you come and you serve. And if we have these Mandelas and other figures in such a council, that will create a much greater balance and control and avoid these excesses where with which one gets away if one represents a government and there are other governments, fellow governments, if you want, that are less likely to react. Well, it's not because my ferry is going, but I've come to the end, and you have long ago maybe come to an end in listening to me talking to you. But I just want to say the road towards a reform is going to be a long one, but we have to start somewhere. I think that the beginning has been made. We have to support and insist that it doesn't fall asleep again as it did in the 80s when there was also an initiative to reform the UN, if for no other reason than the fact that, well, 6.5 billion people are really urgently waiting for that. So thank you very much for your patience. Thank you. Thank you.
So we'll recognize questions.
Okay.
I have two very short questions for you.
Please.
One is, how can we redesign the UN to be more effective in humanitarian intervention situations such as Darfur now? And second, what are your thoughts about how to bring the occupation in Iraq to conclusion? I'm sure you can answer those very quickly. Evidently, the polls show Americans increasingly dissatisfied with the war, but it's like 30% I heard today who want to get out right now, and it seems to me that we need your wisdom on how to talk to people about how to get out so they don't get too frightened about that and we could get out.
Shall we have breakfast tomorrow? or talk until breakfast? These are long, difficult questions, and they must be answered. I can very briefly say the first one, redesign humanitarian interventions. Well, if the powers of the day approach an international issue with a hidden agenda, we will not have an effective intervention. If you decide on a humanitarian intervention and then don't give the resources to equip those who go there, don't be surprised. If you see these decrepit Ethiopian soldiers in the Congo in a peacekeeping operation or an African Union troop in Darfur that is hardly equipped to protect themselves, don't be surprised. Half-hearted stuff isn't going to help. And the UN must be told that over and over again. Don't pretend. If you really mean you want to do something, humanitarian intervention says what it is, what it says. A humanitarian intervention. Then please be humanitarian in your approach. And decide clearly, equip, and then manage properly. Then you have maybe a chance. But that hasn't been the case. It worked. Look at Sierra Leone, where the British were. Well equipped. It worked. they stopped the civil war in Sierra Leone. It didn't work so well at all in Liberia, but it was a scaled-down problem. And in Ethiopia, in the Congo, well, it became rampant. The sexual harassment issues, as far as the peacekeepers in Congo were concerned, probably relate to the fact that it was a poorly managed, poorly led a troop that was there on the spot. So once you decide, please, not just lip service, but you must make a contribution and you must stand behind that contribution. That's one answer. Iraq occupation to conclusion. In Europe, we say if anyone can bring that occupation to a conclusion, then it is the American people themselves. I think it's you are the force that we believe is the strongest force. This is not now trying to be a populist and to try to to make you hot and go out no, not at all. But we are realistic, and we believe that all the preaching, all the pressure, the political pressure from Europe, from Asia, from elsewhere, isn't as helpful as the voice from within. And so let the voices be heard. I hope it will not end because there's suddenly, like a long-distance runner who collapses because he has no more oxygen in his lung. I hope it's not going to be that kind of an ending, that the capacity of the occupation forces is no longer there and it just collapses. As an addendum, I do not think, for example, that U.S. right now has the capacity to go with a conventional force into Iran. I don't think so. It doesn't have it. It doesn't, and it has less and less. Your young boys and girls in Iraq, they are frightened, many of them. I have a son who went there after the war, and a young 18-year-old Marine said to him, I want to go home. And he had tears in his eyes, you know. That's how these young... I feel just as sorry for these GIs as I feel for the Iraqis that are suffering there. They are misled. And they are misled that they're serving their country. They are not serving their country. You know, they're serving nobody. And I'm sorry this was a moment that I became emotional, but I think this is... The end will be... is coming. It can't continue like that. I just hope that it will be a rational decision. We have to change course and we have to withdraw, and not because the capacity is no longer there to remain there. Well, thank you very much.